The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their pieces from the latest issue. This episode, we're going to be joined by Dr. Max Pemberton, who writes about the rise of online GPs and why they don't quite do the job. Then he'll be joined by Andrew Watts, who writes from Cornwall, while it's in the news for the G7 this weekend, about why having a second home there is nothing to be proud of. And finally, we'll hear from Yacinda Maxstone-Graham, who campaigns for the return of choirs. First, it's Max Pemberton.
Where have all the GPs gone? They were some of the first to be double-jabbed, placed ahead of teachers in the queue, precisely so they could resume their work seeing patients in the flesh. But while schools have long been back, GPs have retreated behind their laptops, never to be seen again, at least not in the flesh. Their stethoscope has been replaced by a headset, to the despair of patients with ailments that are hard to diagnose over the phone or via a laptop. In theory, GPs can claim that normal service has resumed. In the pandemic, the number of consultations halved to 3 million a week, in spite of attempts made to keep healthcare running. This is a horrific drop, with consequences that can only be guessed at. This is the problem with ministers urging us to protect the NHS by not using it. People don't seek medical care, including cancer diagnoses. And it will kill as surely as COVID. But GPs say consultations are back now to normal levels with about 6 million appointments a week. But look into the figures and you can see a big flaw. The number of face-to-face appointments is way down, with almost a third fewer in-person appointments happening than there were pre-pandemic, equivalent to about 1.5 million fewer in-person appointments each week. In-person appointments have been replaced by telephone appointments. Their number has tripled from about 850,000 per week pre-pandemic to about 2.3 million a week now. This is not driven by patient demand. It's a downgrade of a vital public service. Under pandemic guidance, GP surgeries have been advised to offer telephone triage first and then face-to-face if deemed clinically necessary. What constitutes necessary remains open to interpretation though. While many GPs have been willing to offer patients either telephone appointments or face-to-face, depending on what they prefer, others appear to have moved almost entirely to virtual appointments. But what possible justification can GPs give for not resuming face-to-face appointments? Now that the vaccine has been rolled out, infection rates are plummeting and other areas of life are starting to get back to normal. Surely this is something that should be prioritised. Given the horrific impact lockdown has had on people accessing healthcare, surely ensuring that GP surgeries are back up and running as usual is paramount. Yet some GPs seem to be dragging their feet. Sure, I get it. Working from home has been a breath of fresh air for many people. It's shown them a different way of working, one that involves wearing your pyjamas with loose women on mute in the background. But medicine isn't like a job in marketing. It's serious. An actual GP appointment where you sit down in front of a doctor is now vanishingly rare in some areas. In just 18 months, it's become something that's considered almost quaint. It's a complaint I've heard time and time again from my own patients in mental health, where they have tried to see their GP. It's left hospital doctors, such as myself, baffled because the rest of the NHS has started to open up. In mental health, I've almost entirely abandoned phone appointments because it just isn't the same. So much is lost from the clinical encounter when it's done over the phone. And the majority of patients didn't just prefer seeing someone in person, they actively hated appointments conducted over the phone. Of course, there will always be people who prefer the convenience of a Skype or phone call, but they tend to be those with simple, straightforward problems, in-out type cases. But what about all the people with complex problems, with difficult, nuanced, multifaceted problems? Things where you need to examine the patient, or you get a hunch just by looking at them. You know, the stuff that doctors actually trained to be good at dealing with. Now, this isn't about GP bashing. This is about standing up for patients whose voice is all too often never heard and insisting that doctors listen to them. The NHS this week directed GPs to see children with coughs or breathing problems face to face and refer to a specialist if necessary. But it's odd that they need to be told and speaks to the wider problem. What really gets to me is that we all know the people that will suffer. It will be the old, the poor, the mentally ill, the disenfranchised. They don't form Twitter campaigns or launch legal action or even write letters of complaint. They just sit at home wondering if that strange pain in their chest that's been there every time they walk up the stairs is anything to worry about, or the odd lump that's appeared in their armpit is maybe just a swollen gland. They are why the poor die younger than the rich, and why the response from primary care, if it continues to refuse to see people face to face, will mean that this gross inequality will simply be magnified again and again. It's been argued that the move to telephone appointments is actually good for the NHS, that they are more efficient. Yet the data does not support this at all. Despite moving to phone appointments, the number of appointments happening the same day has barely changed. It was about 40% pre-pandemic, and it's about 43% now. So there's been no meaningful increase in efficiency at all. Yes, the pandemic has been difficult and trying on those in the health service. But really, there is no excuse to not start seeing patients in person. It's what the vast majority of them really want. I think it's also telling that the private sector hasn't seen the same reticence to resume seeing patients face to face. Quite the opposite, in fact. Private doctors quickly realised that this is what patients wanted and were back behind their desks as soon as they were allowed. Friends who work privately talk of doing a roaring trade in patients who actually want to see a doctor, rather than try to explain their problem to a distant voice over the phone. Why doesn't this stick in the craw of NHS GPs who, surely, can see how the pandemic has already deepened inequality and how refusing to see patients face to face is creating a two-tier system whereby those who can afford it are simply going elsewhere? It wasn't like this to start with. I was astonished at the way general practice responded to the pandemic. It organised itself in lightning speed, and it was inspiring to see how GPs pulled together and mobilised in this way. They put many hospitals to shame in how quickly they adapted. But now something has changed. In hindsight, I can't help but wonder if the pandemic didn't tap into something that was already brewing. GPs were already frustrated and frazzled. And now they've been given a taste of a different pace and lifestyle, which means they can have the flexibility and ease of logging in from home and the peace of a surgery not crammed with moaning, wailing patients. But I fear that if GPs continue in this vein, they'll be shooting themselves in the foot. They'll lose the public's goodwill that has been built up over the pandemic, and it will damage the NHS, as people will start to question whether the health service really has their best interests at heart. Patients describe delays and frustrations trying to get through on the phone, being refused face-to-face appointments, and struggling to deal with new technology such as video consultations and online booking systems. General practice often comes in for criticism from the public. Most of it is unfair given the tremendous stresses and strains that they are under. But those who are refusing to see patients in person do absolutely nothing to ingratiate themselves to the public. In fact, it feeds directly into the suspicion amongst some that many GPs have long viewed their patients with a certain disdain and irritation. It makes them look self-centred and disinterested in their patients. What a tragedy it would be if this became the prevailing view of modern general practice. The old complaint of never seeing the same GP twice has now been replaced with a far more serious one, never seeing the GP at all.
That was Max Pemberton, and now Andrew Watts.
Last week, there was a public toilet for sale on the coast of Cornwall. The Kent-based auctioneer called it an exciting and rare opportunity, although its video tour of the property did not even undo the padlock on the security door. It was on the market for £20,000, which was a bargain. The last exciting and rare toilet block to be auctioned in Cornwall went for five times its asking price, even though it didn't have as nice a view. It did, however, have windows. It's undeniable that the property market in Cornwall is overheating. The backlash to the toilet auction was such that it was withdrawn from sale, but house prices in parts of the duchy are increasing at double the national average. Property searches have gone up 140% in 2 years. And last month, a bungalow in Port Isaac sold within 5 minutes of the listing going online. Some of this bubble is the result of movement out of cities. But the part that causes resentment is second homes. Cornwall has 1% of England's population and 17% of its second homes. In some towns, second homes are the majority. Already the signs are going up in the southwest. No more second homes, our village is dying. The withholding of planning consent for new builds, unless they are guaranteed not to become holiday homes, is well-intentioned, but merely intensifies the problem within the existing housing stock, and villages such as Mousel are becoming as empty over winter as they are overrun during summer. My son, like every schoolchild in Cornwall, loves the story of the Mousel Cat, in which Tom Bawcock goes fishing in a storm so that the village children will not starve. And he pretends not to see Daddy crying when we get to the bit about the villagers standing with lights on the quay to guide the boat back into port. Even he notices when we walk round the harbour in December and see not a single light in any of the windows. It's easy to see this as an issue of rich against poor, but the rich are not the problem. The properly rich in Cornwall, that is, the people who made money from tin 100 years ago or from captured prizes 200 years ago, have estates, and they have given several families I know their only chance of renting within an hour's journey of their work. I also know of people who bought buy-to-let property and take justifiable pride in the fact that they rent it to local people rather than as holiday accommodation. But even a Tory romantic like me will have to admit that there is not enough noblesse oblige to go round. Other friends rely on landlords who collect the rent in cash. More to the point, if the issue is simply rich versus poor, it is quite easy for the rich to show that they bring money to Cornwall. Tourism generates millions for the local economy. But that has nothing to do with having a second home. Contractors and tradesmen would have work to do whether the houses were owned by local families or visitors. And it would be business coming in all the year round, rather than just in the summer. I am convinced that the best way to attack second homers is not to mock them for being too rich, but to attack them as cheapskates. For all the locals' complaints about being outbid by people from London, the second homers often pay less. It is only this year that the government agreed to close the loophole that second homes could avoid council tax by registering as businesses, and avoid business rates by qualifying for small business rates relief, and thus contribute nothing to local services. Even the price of the property can be less if it's a second home. I was talking to someone selling her house in Cornwall, who admitted that her mortgage was interest only, and so less than half the price it would have been if she'd been paying off the capital. In effect, she had rented her property for a few years, then had the rent refunded in full. A local person, who doesn't have a house in London to move into or sell at the end of the mortgage term, can't compete with that. Since house price inflation outstripped interest rates, as it usually does, she was in effect paid for having a holiday home. I have never seen the point of having a holiday home. Why would you spend hours travelling to do exactly the same chores as at home, but nearer to the sea? The only reason for a self-catering holiday at all is if you can't afford to go to a hotel, and there is no shame in that. But there is, or should be, shame if you could afford to stay in a hotel and decide instead to be cheap and buy a second home. We need to stop pretending that having a holiday home in Cornwall is an aspirational lifestyle choice. We need to stop saying, "Oh, you've got a little place near Polzeath, lucky you," and start saying, "Can you not afford a hotel? Shame."
That was Andrew Watts, and finally, Yacenda Maxtone-Graham.
And now we sing our final hymn, number 466. Remember that? The euphoria of congregational hymn singing? The well-organised types always had the book open at the correct page, balanced precariously on the pew. The rest of us hurriedly flicked to 466 while singing the first verse, knowing it by heart from 1,000 school assemblies. Our shield and defender, the Ancient of Days. I can't believe I'm writing this in the past tense, but it has been so long, almost 15 months, since anyone not in a choir sang a congregational hymn. How I miss that light-headedness, almost faintness, of standing up after a long service and singing your heart out, filling and emptying your lungs, fortified by the tiny wafer and sip of sweet wine. The experience was always tinged with relief. Phew, we did it. Survived the sermon. Wasn't too bad. Gosh, still managed to be an hour and a half long. But mainly it brought us all together into a heightened state at that final moment before the doors were flung open and we were released back into the Cowparsley churchyard. Much has been written about the Department for Culture, Media and Sport's absurd edict announced last month that only up to 6 amateur singers are allowed to sing indoors in England, even in a large ventilated hall, church or cathedral, while everyone is allowed to shout in pubs, sing in football stadiums and huff and puff in gyms. Not only is it scientifically dubious, the doctor and voice expert Declan Costello's experiments last year proved that singing produced no more aerosols than speaking. It's a rule clearly dreamed up by Philistines, because the number 6 makes no sense in musical terms, most choral music being in 4 parts or 8 parts, but rarely in 6. The rules have forced amateur choirs to rehearse in the acousticless outdoors, only 30 allowed even there, or to run 12 consecutive rehearsals for 6 singers each, or more often to cancel their rehearsal bookings and long-planned summer concerts. But what about us, the hymn-singing masses? We've had to endure more than a year of dismal hymnlessness, dry services without the necessary gravy of communal singing to make us feel part of it. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, as the psalmist put it. Listening to a choir singing a hymn, though better than nothing, is not an acceptable substitute. You feel excluded sitting there in bovine silence while others sing the words you long to belt out. Some congregations have taken to humming very softly behind their masks, longing to mouth the words but resisting for fear of a backlash from the diocese. Even in New York, famous for being almost manically COVID-compliant, the rules have now been eased, I'm told, by Jeremy Filsell, the director of music at St. Thomas's Church, Fifth Avenue. Congregations are allowed to sing hymns if masked and socially distanced. I spoke to the Reverend Mark Roberts, rector of my hometown of Sandwich, Kent, who said that the absence of hymn singing had been very hard for his congregation. Lots of people, he said, might not remember the words of the Bible, but they do remember and need to sing the words of well-loved hymns to sustain them through hard times. Singing is at the heart of praise. Praise is at the heart of worship. So to remove singing is to begin to neuter what worship is about. The soprano Catherine Jenkins, who presents songs of praise and worships at St David's Church in Neath, Wales, tells me, perhaps we didn't really appreciate how much we loved hymns till we lost them. They bring us together, take the emotion up a notch. When we're allowed to sing them again, it will be a very emotional moment. If it's been hard for my type of worship up at the high end, how much harder has it been for evangelicals, whose services normally kick off with half an hour of communal singing to get everyone into the groove? A friend who sings in an evangelical church in West London tells me that whereas she used to lead the congregation singing at her church by standing at the front singing into a microphone, she now has to become a solo performer, singing to the masked, silent congregation, accompanied by 4 masked guitarists. It's hard for anyone to reach a state of spiritual ecstasy under those restrictions. And how much have school pupils been deprived? They've missed a year of building up their bank of hymn poetry that should be there to sustain them through all the changing scenes of life. No communal hymn singing in school assemblies has taken place since before the first lockdown last year. Assemblies have been held on Zoom, broadcast to classroom bubbles. At boarding school, singing has been restricted to house bubbles. Again, better than nothing. It was heartbreaking to read about a primary school pupil who announced to her mother that singing spreads germs. That bit of propaganda will prove hard to shift. The nation's craving for hymns became clear last month when more than 1,000 people took part in an online hymn-singing concert organised by the recently formed Self-Isolation Choir, dreamed up by Ralph Allwood, to raise money for choral charities. I watched it and was moved to tears, both by the emotional power of the hymns themselves and by the thought of those 1,000 hymn enthusiasts who had managed to sing alone into their smartphones and upload the result onto Dropbox. Amateur singing is a soft target for the government. The silencing of indoor singing is an easy way for them to be seen to be being efficiently cautious. To most of us with common sense, it seems grossly unfair, disproportionate and emasculating. Watch the recent Twitter video of the choral conductor Sam Evans singing into a candle flame, and it doesn't so much as flicker. He then speaks to say, 2 pints of beer and a packet of crisps, and the candle goes out. Communal hymn singing had better come back in time for the belting out of Jerusalem or even Shine Jesus Shine from school assembly halls on the final day of term next month. But I don't dare to be hopeful, judging by the government's roundhead approach.
That was Yosendo Maxtone Graham And thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. To read any of the pieces that were read out in this week's episode, do pick up an issue of The Spectator, and you can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12 if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher, where you'll also get a free £20 Amazon voucher. So why wait? Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.